Wine and Crime contains graphic and explicit content which may not be suitable for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Listening to Wine and Crime, the podcast where three friends chug wine, chat true crime, and unleash their worst Minnesotan accents.
You know it.
Yeah.
I will be chugging wine today.
Yes.
So, I'm Kenyon.
Yes.
I'm Lucy.
Yeah, I'm Amanda. I'm exhausted.
I love hot dish.
I really love hot dish.
We've been recording every day, and we're going to be rocking recording every days. Day. Yeah. Yep.
Real Friday Night Lights situation happening here.
Yeah. We're so tired. And we haven't started yet. We're too old for this shit.
We decided it wasn't worth it.
Mm-hmm. We're disbanding.
It's been
just
fun.
Just kidding. We literally have lost all other skills to, like, survive in the workplace, so we can't. Leave the podcast.
No identity outside of the podcast.
None.
So anyway, that's healthy. the topic of this episode is a very special fan pick. Mm-hmm. The topic is games gone wrong.
Oh yeah. I found myself really sad that I like did the bridge card game case in 1920s crimes.
Yes. Yeah.
We'll get to it.
That was so amazing. That
it's
one.
My favorite
Go listen
case.
To that episode if you haven't already.
That case and the lady falling or like jumping out of her own grave case are my two favorite cases I've ever done.
Mm-hmm. Your art theft case was really good too.
That was also really good.
All right. So like role playing games gone wrong or like Dungeons and Dragons.
We'll get to Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh,
that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I will have lots to interject there because I played for a decade.
I can't wait for you to interrupt my entire segment.
You're welcome.
The Cones of Dunshire.
Ah, Dunshire.
Dunshire. Okay. So this fan pick is brought to you by, I love this, it's brought to you by a group called Wine and Dice.
Yeah.
Which is a spin-off group where role players chug wine, roll dice, and unleash their worst character accents.
I love it so much.
It's so good. And so it's like this group of people that play this game together, and these are their names. So they all pitched in for this fan pick episode. Emily Waters, Katie White, Mary Kate Heineman, Aileen Parr, Mary Calvert, and Mahua Chakraborty. So thank you all from the Wine and Dice Party.
Oh my God, thank
you. Yes.
I want to be your friend.
I know, I want to play. So let's get right into it. Amanda, what is our wine crime pairing for Games Gone Wrong?
Well, Wink crushed it again this week with the Endgame Chardonnay.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So I have a lot to say about Chardonnay before I get into it. Just a reminder that Wink is an amazing online wine club that delivers wine to your door, and you can become a member or just order a la carte, but I recommend becoming a member today. And if you've never checked out their website, go do it. And if you've never ordered from them before, go do it at trywink.com/gals for $20 off your first box. Put four or more bottles of wine in your cart and they take care of the shipping and then you get that $20 off. It's a steal of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
So good. So we all know how I feel about Chardonnay, and a lot of people feel the same way. So I literally Googled, quote, why do people hate Chardonnay?
Because people have taste buds.
Right. But I found a great article in the Chicago Tribune titled Stop Hating Chardonnay, the Anything But Chardonnay Crowd Has It Wrong, written by a guy named Michael Austin in 2015. He's a sommelier. Aww. And I wanted to share a few favorite lines because it did kind of turn me around a little bit. So he says, quote, you can hate coffee or oysters or Coldplay, preach, but if you have even the slightest interest in wine, you cannot hate Chardonnay. That would be like claiming to be an animal lover, but hating dogs because every once in a while they bite someone or eat a whole box of crayons, which is fair.
Or they stink. Yep. Or when you pet them, your fingers smell.
You need to pet a clean dog. Anyway.
Show me a clean dog and I might change my mind. I've never met a clean dog.
Wow.
You haven't met Josie.
That's true. Generally, Chardonnay is a dry, medium-bodied wine with medium to high acidity. It's versatile and a sturdy grape, which has no doubt contributed to its popularity, as it can thrive just about anywhere wine grapes grow. This is also why there are so many styles of it. It does best in cooler climates, and when it's grown there, it can make for flinty, minerally crisp wines, which is like way more like Sauv Blanc.
That sounds good. Yeah,
yep,
exactly.
With suggestions of lemon or green apple, nuts, or even smoke. In warmer regions, it produces more lush flavors ranging from peach to pineapple, melon, and honey. Notice that cream, vanilla, or butter did not appear in the flavor descriptions of those climates. Butter happens in the winemaking process. It is a choice that the winemaker makes. It's a horrible fucking choice. Mm-hmm. And it is easily avoidable or attainable by you, the consumer. So when people say they don't care for Chardonnay, I politely suggest that perhaps they don't care for certain styles of Chardonnay.
This guy sounds like he'd be fun at a party.
I know. Oh, yeah. He's probably the fucking worst, but he is raising a good point.
He wears a fedora.
Oh, yeah. And really slurps and spits.
Oh.
The worst. Often they think that Chardonnay equals butterscotch. The fact is, only some Chardonnay equals butterscotch, and in those cases, it is because the winemaker was overzealous with oak. So this particular bottle that we're going to be popping into today is far less oaky. I will say that I have had crisp, delightful, un-oaked Chardonnays that I really liked because they drink a lot more like Sauv Blancs. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I can't say that I blanket hate Chardonnay. I agree with this person. I prefer an un-oaked Chardonnay.
It's just a little riskier. You know, if you've never had it before.
Yeah,
it is risky.
Bottle.
It is risky, and if you're dining at a restaurant where your server or the bartender on staff doesn't know much about wine, it can be hard to then ask, can I get a recommendation on a Chardonnay or do you have an un-oaked Chardonnay? Because a lot of people just won't right off the top of their head know the answer to that question.
I can tell by the color a lot of times.
Oh, yeah. Oaked Chardonnays are really yellow. Mm-hmm. They literally look like melted butter, like clarified melted butter.
They look like Kenyon's pea a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
Yep.
Right. Exactly.
So if you want to take a risk on a Chardonnay, I would go to your local liquor store, go to Total Wine, you know, and actually talk to somebody who works there and say, hey, I'm looking for this style. Hey, Matt, I want an un-oaked Chardonnay. And they will guide you and you can kind of like feel comfortable within your price range and then really get a feel for what kind of Chardonnay you like. And then you'll know exactly what to ask for if you go out to a restaurant. That would be my recommendation. Mm-hmm. So this particular bottle is far less oaky. It's barrel fermented for extra texture and provides an excellent example of deliciously different Chardonnay. The nose presents mouthwatering scents of butterscotch, so that there is a little bit of oak aging here, but it's a lot less. So you are going to get some of that butteriness, but it should not be overwhelming and gross. Balanced out by yellow fruit, but on the palate, tart lemon notes cut right through the creamy texture for a luxurious, surprisingly refreshing sip. So this is a Chardonnay that I feel like I can get way more on board for.
All right, let's do it.
Should we roll the dice? Woo! Woo! All right, here we go. I definitely pre-prepped this cork because Chardonnay corks are like notoriously unrelenting.
Yeah.
They are so hard to pull out. That's what he said. All right. We ready?
Mm-hmm.
And.
Oh, not so buttery.
Butter pop.
Buttery pop.
Here we
or
go.
Or not. We'll see.
Let's try it.
All right. Well, cheers.
Ooh.
Cheers.
I don't hate it.
Yeah?
Yeah. There's definitely a hint of like a creamy texture, but I'm feeling it like it's more mouthfeel than actual flavor, which I'm fine with.
Okay. Yeah, definitely.
It finishes way drier.
Mm. I don't hate a creamy mouthfeel.
Yeah, I think y'all would actually like this.
Okay.
So, I don't know. Give it a try.
I'll keep my mind open.
I like an open mind.
I don't often do that, but today for you, I will.
Mm-hmm. I will gift this bottle to Lucy's mom who drinks Chardonnay and then have a sip of it.
but she loves oaky Chardonnay, which is why I grew up. I didn't grow up thinking that I hated Chardonnay. After I was of legal drinking age and started drinking her Chardonnay,
14,
I was like, wow, I don't like wine. We've come a long
that
way.
Changed.
We've come a long way.
All right. Well, cheers.
Cheers.
And
Charles.
Lucy, what is our background and maybe psych for why on earth people play Dungeons and Dragons?
Oh my gosh. Or just games in general. Mine, my case is not about Dungeons and Dragons, just to be perfectly clear. It's a different game.
Okay, mine is not either. It's sort of adjacent, but no.
Let's not pigeonhole ourselves into a Dungeons and Dragons episode, because mine is not even a role-playing game.
I will be discussing Dungeons and Dragons plenty.
Good. I'm glad. Right. I am glad. I'm just warning everyone, I did not follow that rule.
Okay. So games are one of the oldest forms of human interaction, an integral component of all cultures, pretty much as far back as Homo sapiens have existed. An exceedingly dry definition of games from Wikipedia reads, quote, games are formalized expressions of play which allow people to go beyond immediate imagination and direct physical activity. Common features of games include uncertainty of outcome, agreed upon rules, competition, separate place and time, elements of fiction, elements of chance, prescribed goals, and personal enjoyment.
Yes.
That's, yeah. Definitely nailed it.
Yep. So that's my segment. Moving on. Just kidding. So games are representative of a culture's worldview and range in significance from simple social bonding to teaching tools to markers of social status to significant religious components to really, really expensive gifts. So games are all over the fucking place.
In the two things that tear families apart like Monopoly.
Oh, God, yes. In the 1938 book Homo Ludens, Dutch cultural historian and cultural theorist Johan Huizinga positions games as a starting point for complex human activities such as language, law, war, philosophy, and art.
Okay.
Prehistoric games were often
and
played—
And Uno.
Prehistoric games were often played with different types of bones, commonly foot bones and knuckle bones, because there were a lot of like really small ones.
That's your type of shit.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. People also use things like shells and sticks. And these items also often played a role in divination and religious or spiritual ceremonies. And there's evidence that they're at some point in certain cultures, there really was no difference between sacred rituals and, like, just for funsies.
I can kind of see that because, what's the difference? We can't really unpack the difference between, like, chance and fate.
Yeah.
So we've just kind of assigned different importance to these things, but philosophically, they're kind of the same thing.
Yeah, and so, like, sort of in the same vein, at a certain point when, like, people were constantly fighting for survival, what does leisure time look like? Maybe leisure time is the chance for them to use their imaginations and, like, think about spiritual rituals.
Yeah, maybe. Mm-hmm.
It's just other than survival, you know?
Definitely.
And, yeah, it definitely is a big way to use your creative mind. Like, my friend has been running the same, well, not the same, but a D&D campaign for going on 20 years, and he writes everything from scratch, and it's, like, such a creative outlet for him and the people that play. Like, it's pretty involved and really incredible. But it takes a lot of time. It's a commitment.
Yeah, it really is. So the oldest kinds of games were pretty much dice-oriented. The first evidence of board games dates back to the Fertile Crescent. So, like, modern-day Iraq, Turkey, Syria, Egypt area.
Is it bad if I want to refer to my downstairs now as the Fertile Crescent?
You are not the first, and you won't be the last.
All right. That's validating.
You're also not that fertile. You're on the pill.
No, I'm that's 100% true. Not fertile at the moment.
And the barren crescent.
There it is. The girdle crescent.
So this was around like 5,000 years ago. They were probably used by rich people and given as diplomatic gifts. And many of these games had to do with a checkered board and different teams of game pieces. So they were like sort of like various types of chess.
Cool.
Yeah, obviously different. Yeah, different rules, different ways of playing, but fairly close, and also fairly complicated.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Chess itself originated in the Arab world, and they were super fucking into it, publishing treaties on its rules and like tactics and shit. Like, they were really fucking into it. And fun fact: the term checkmate comes from the Persian term shamat, which means the king is dead.
Ooh.
Oh, that's so cool.
I like that.
Yeah, so checkmate as English words, quote unquote, doesn't mean anything. It comes from Persian.
Wow.
Yeah. And playing cards were first used in Asia and India around the year 1300.
That's late.
I know. Well, I mean, paper?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know when paper was invented.
Well, it was invented in Asia, like in China.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know when it, I don't know when.
Yeah. There's no way to know.
Mm-hmm.
Ball games date back to ancient Greece and the Roman Empire. They also had tic-tac-toe, which was called tourney la pili. Lisa Lampanelli.
That's so cute. Oh,
yeah. And checkers. Romans were primarily responsible for spreading these games all over the Roman Empire. So there are three photos on the drive, which will be on the blog, and I've labeled them Old Ass Game 1, 2, and 3, if you want to take a look at them.
Flawless.
All right, as we go to look, do either of you know how to play chess, like actually?
No clue.
Really?
I did, one time. My dad taught me once.
Yeah, I think I did a little bit.
Exited my brain.
Playing when I was like a child.
Mm-hmm.
I have never had the patience.
Yeah, once, it's too hard.
Once you get it, it's really fun. But, like, I don't remember how to play it. I played it, like, pretty regularly for, like, a two-week stretch when I was in my teens, and I don't remember how to do this again anymore.
I don't have the time. These games
are pretty.
Yeah, they're beautiful. Yeah. I like this.
So you can see why they were used as, like, diplomatic tools, as, like, gifts
and stuff. Oh, totally.
Mm-hmm.
Totally. You can hash out a lot of stuff sitting and chatting over some games and drinking some tea or what have you.
Exactly. Polo was first played in the 2nd and 3rd centuries AD in Persia and the Byzantine Empire, but now we're getting a little too close to sports, and I don't care enough about sports, so that's enough about that.
Yep, good.
Love
good
it.
Call. I approve.
The Wine and Dice folks suggested that I share a little bit of background about one game in particular that has sort of a zany history, and if you couldn't have guessed, that would be Dungeons & Dragons.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
D&D.
I do not understand.
Oh, no.
So please explain.
Well, D&D is a fantasy role-playing tabletop game, or RPG role-playing game, first published in 1974. D&D is commonly recognized as the beginning of modern role-playing games. The game is modeled after war-playing games, but each player is allowed to create and develop their own player who embarks on imaginary adventures within a fantasy setting. They solve problems, engage in battles, and gather treasure and knowledge. The so-called Dungeon Master is like the referee slash storyteller, like slash narrator.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some sort of point system as well that I didn't care enough to get into, but there are points.
Fair enough. What I don't understand is the Dungeon Master writes something, but then each player also like has agency to like make stuff up, but then what are the parameters for what
there
they
are
make
so
up?
Many books. There's like a library of books for different campaigns and the basic structure of those campaigns.
They're
that
like a choose
rules.
Your own adventure.
Yes.
It's like a group choose your own adventure.
Yep. So the Dungeon Master does have to be kind of like versatile in the sense that, yes, they write a narrative, but they do have to be able to adjust that narrative depending on the choices that the characters get to make, because they do have some agency. But those choices are also within like a list of rules that regulate of what they can do in that encounter, in each individual encounter.
Okay, so they can't be like, boom, I grew wings and flew out of that.
No. Can't do that.
Okay. And the dungeon master isn't like an adversary, right?
They're not like playing, is my understanding. They're just overseeing.
They're not a character.
Not necessarily. They're typically not a character that's part of like the guild that is adventuring, but they encompass basically all of the characters that guild encounters.
Gotcha.
So you might, in like one, we literally would sit down and play for like 8 hours. So in 1 8-hour session, Robbie, our DM, would be the character of like 10 different monsters that we encountered, or like different villagers we had to question, or, you know, whatever. So he still is playing a multitude of roles while the other people sitting at the table are playing the one role that's associated with the character they've built.
They're doing all the voices.
It's incredible. Robbie is so good at it. And I've been trying to get him to do a podcast of his D&D game because it's hilarious and I would listen to it so hard. But
he would be so good at it. Hi,
Robbie. He'd be so good at it.
Yeah, Robbie, do this.
He might just make Dungeons & Dragons interesting to me.
It literally, I'd had no interest in playing, and I was dating someone who was a big old nerd and super into it. And obviously, Robbie's a big old nerd and super into it. Love you. Mm-hmm. And they like convinced me to play, and I got so deep into it. I played for years. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. And my same friends that I used to play with are all still playing together after like 20 years of playing.
Does the game ever just die?
Yeah, does it ever end?
Yes, story arcs do come to completion and end, and then they start new campaigns.
Okay. So it's not like a game of Monopoly, a never-ending game of Monopoly.
Literally a never-ending game of Monopoly.
Mm. Okay.
All right.
So as of 2004, D&D was the best-known, best-selling RPG in the United States, with an estimated 20 million players and more than $1 billion in book and equipment sales worldwide.
It's bonkers.
So what is the equipment?
There are like minis, projectors, books. Like Robbie's setup, they have like minis to represent like every kind of monster you could possibly encounter, every kind of character you
could
be.
Mini meaning like a figurine.
Yep, like little figurines. They also have like a magic marker game board that's a grid so that you can put your character like on a game board, and then you can move them around and like see how they are in the environment. They used to have a literal projector screen where they would like project images to go along with the encounter that you're in. He curates a musical playlist for it's like so incredibly well curated. It's amazing. But you can spend a lot of money on D&D shit. Like, but it's big.
Bare bones, if you only had that weirdo looking dice, could you play with nothing else?
Yep. When we first started our campaign, we had printed off our character sheets off of like the free D&D website where you can print the sheets for free. Built our characters. We literally doodled the images of our own characters just to like play around and see what they would look like. And we had dice a lot. I didn't have my own dice, so I would share dice with other people until I finally went and bought a set of dice for like $4. The books are the most expensive, but you can start with like the most basic D&D how-to manual, and then there are so many other versions of the game that you can play. So a lot of the different books are like, oh, this is a specialized campaign that you can try out, but you don't need it to play the game.
Okay.
I saw that because my cousin is into D&D, and so I saw like an article on Facebook and forwarded it to him, but it's a castle in Ireland that they've converted into a hotel, but just for D&D fans.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So
I love it.
Go and you're staying in an actual Irish castle in the countryside for a weekend or whatever, and it's not cheap. And you just play Dungeons & Dragons the whole time.
That would be like my friend's absolute paradise.
Mm-hmm.
I love it.
Yep.
There's something out there for everyone. I would not have the patience, but now that I understand it better, it makes more sense.
It's really cool.
Yeah. So this all sounds innocent enough, but in the 1980s, a bunch of teetotaling church ladies went on daytime talk shows to share their wholly unfounded opinions that Dungeons and Dragons was driving the youth into the arms of Satan and suicide.
Of course. So that and the rock music.
And Harry Potter.
Metallica. We have discussed this satanic panic of the 80s in a previous episode. I don't remember which one, but we have discussed it.
Oh, yeah.
So we don't need to dive into it too deeply. But Dungeons and Dragons in particular played a pretty key role in this specific moral panic. So in 1983, a woman named Patricia Pulling formed the group BADD, B-A-D-D, which stood
for... Get out of here.
Which stood for Bothered About Dungeons and Dragons.
You are fucking kidding.
I'm not fucking kidding. This is real.
Let's start a group called H-BAD, Hot and Bothered About Dungeons and Dragons.
H-BAC?
H-BAC.
Oh, I could. There are so many things to be bothered about. Why fucking bother the nerds?
That's not
about
even
it?
A good act. It's such a stretch, and like a stretch acronym is one of my pet peeves. But then it's even worse when it's a stretch to a BADD acronym. Mm-hmm. Literally, yeah. BADD.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, granted, our acronym Always Be Branding Ah was just created so we can use the like word ABBA. ABBA. Yep.
Oh, that's tongue in cheek.
Mm-hmm. And it's ABBA. Hello. You can't go wrong. Yeah.
Also, fucking trademark Always Be Branding Ah. Mm-hmm. ABBA.
Yep.
So, to be fair, Patricia Pulling's son at the time had recently died by suicide and had also been really into RPGs. So, her grief turned rather irrational, though, when she filed a wrongful death lawsuit against her son's high school principal for what she claimed was a D&D curse placed by him onto her son's character shortly before his death.
Oh, Patricia, so, like, honey.
She's fucking cray.
I feel bad because, like you said, it's her grief, and so it's and that's the hardest possible thing imaginable to lose a child.
But a lot of people jumped on board and encouraged this shit.
Yeah. Which is exploitative and awful.
The poor principal who's like going above and beyond doing their job to play these nerdy ass games with troubled kids.
Enjoy your husband's future now.
Yeah.
Great. I'm scared. Need to get him liability insurance.
Yeah. Defamation, curse insurance.
Curse
insurance. Incursions.
I need curse insurance.
Oh, my God. So when that fell through, predictably, she founded BADD, which, as a reminder, is Bothered About Dungeons and Dragons.
I love that it's worst. Bothered.
I know, bothered. It should be PAD, peeved about Dungeons and Dragons. Yeah.
PPP. ADD. Patricia Pulling peeved about Dungeons and Dragons.
Padded. Well, mad was already taken. She could have had miffed about Dungeons and Dragons.
Miffed.
I'm really chapped.
Send in your alternative acronyms for Patricia to our social media, please. I want to hear all of yours and what they stand for.
Well, pretty sure Patricia's dead, but, you know, I still want to see him.
Yeah.
Okay, so she founded BADD, which sought to regulate the sale of the game and which describes Dungeons and Dragons as, quote, a fantasy role-playing game which uses demonology, witchcraft, voodoo, murder, rape, blasphemy, suicide, assassination, insanity, sex perversion, homosexuality, prostitution, satanic-type rituals, gambling, barbarism, cannibalism, sadism, desecration, demon summoning, necromantics, divination, and other teachings.
Literally all the best things.
Yeah, I know. What's the difference between demon summoning and demonology?
Your guess is as good as mine.
Mm-hmm. I mean, summoning is pretty specific. ology is pretty wide ranging.
All right. Okay. Mm-hmm. So demon summoning falls under demonology, we think.
I mean, demon summoning just sounds like the specific act of summoning a demon, and maybe demonology is more about like
studying demons.
Studying the demons.
It would literally be the study of demons. So yeah.
Yeah.
This list just gives me dry mouth. It's awful. So Bad's media blitz contributed to a whole shit ton of ridiculous coverage of the game as related to suicides, homicides, and all sorts of other crimes committed by quote-unquote disturbed youth at the time.
Ugh. Oh my God.
So here are some uniquely bizarre mentions of D&D in the media in the 80s. This is from a report in the Omaha World Herald. Quote, "We aren't sure at this point whether we have a double suicide or a suicide homicide," Police Chief Larry Stallcup said. The police chief said Dungeons & Dragons appeals to very intelligent people, plus Amanda, who use their imagination.
Okay. That was unnecessarily cruel.
I'm just kidding. Appeals to very intelligent people who use their imagination to manipulate characters and work through a series of mazes to achieve treasures and avoid falling into the dungeon. My understanding is that once you reach a certain point where you are the master, your only way out is death, Stallcup said. That way, no one can beat you.
That makes no sense.
It makes no sense.
I don't think it might make perfect sense in the game, but I don't think so.
Do you ever become a master? Or that's just decided at the beginning of the game if you're the, whatever, story master, dungeon master.
Yeah, the dungeon master. We've never done that where, like, in the middle of the campaign, there's, like, something you can do to take over as the dungeon master. But that said, because there are so many books and so many versions of the game that you can play, that might be a version of the game that you could play.
Uh-huh.
But we never played like that. And even now, like, yes, somebody else does DM, like guest DM from time to time, but it's a separate campaign.
Gotcha. Okay.
That would just be really hard and confusing because there are so many moving parts and like so many storylines to keep straight that I feel like it would be really hard to switch DMs as part of the game during a campaign. That would like totally throw me off.
Something tells me Officer Stallcup has no fucking idea what he's talking about.
Yeah, who knows?
Exactly.
So here are some quotes from a 1986 article from the Richmond Times-Dispatch entitled, "Game Said to Inspire Mind, Raise Satan."
Well, we don't want the youth's thinking.
Right.
That can call Satan.
Mm-hmm. Sharon Sippos, a Chesterfield County housewife and mother of two who has spoken out against the game on about 30 radio and television programs throughout the nation, believes D&D is not merely a game, but a, quote, alternate lifestyle. Miss Sippos, says she is engaged in a, quote, spiritual battle led by the Lord.
Oh my God.
She is opposed.
Help the poor.
Oh God. Find something fucking better to do.
Go wash someone's feet and shut up.
Yeah. And feed the fucking poor. Yeah.
Go volunteer at a soup kitchen. My God.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She is opposed not only to Dungeons and Dragons, but to all fantasy role-playing games, including a so-called Christian version of D&D called Dragon Raid. She said scripture is used as magic in that game, which she believes is associated with the occult.
Can you imagine? Let's get our hands on Dragon Raid.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Remember when we played, I think fans sent us that game, the Salem Witchcraft game.
Yeah, that was so fun.
And we played it at the like VW or whatever, VW up by your cabin.
At the Moose Lodge. Oh, yep. That was fun. That was really fun. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Miss Sippo said players devote all their time and attention to the fantasy game, even when they're not playing. Quote, they're always planning what they will do the next time. Kids have lost jobs, flunked out of school. They totally confuse reality and fantasy, says Mrs. Sippos. The game becomes their god.
Jeez. What is her even relation to this game? There is no way her children play this game. She just seized on this random crusade.
She's engaged in a spiritual battle led by the Lord.
Oh, right.
Right.
So finally, this is from a Capital Times article called "Officials Offer Warning of Trend Toward Satanism." I love this.
Sounds scientific.
Madison officer Maureen Wall says she sees, quote, nocturnal youths ranging from about age 15 to 20 roaming State Street as she works her night shift. The youths,
literally our childhood.
Right? Yep. The youths may be flashing symbols of Satan on their jackets or wearing pins through their noses or stuck in their cheeks. The outrageousness of their appearance is part of the power they seek, she said. The youths may act out their Satan worship through suicide, rituals, physical or sexual abuse, burglary of ritualistic paraphernalia, animal mutilation, which is spelled as mutliation, criminal damage to property, and drug use.
You know what, lady? Be way more concerned about the, like, captain of the football team who gets fucking hammered every weekend and, like, commits date rape.
Right.
Not to, like, paint a broad brush, but you know what I'm saying? Like, don't worry about these little nerdlets playing their fucking board games.
Uh-huh. Exactly. So
worry about rape culture.
The rest of this article continues. Their activities may involve secrecy, heavy metal music, books describing rituals, literally, yes, part of the game.
Like the Bible.
Exactly. Ritualistic paraphernalia and graffiti to churches. Cemeteries may be vandalized in an attempt to obtain bones for their rituals. Much of the paraphernalia is available through catalogs.
Just wait till she gets a load of the internet.
Oh,
she is gonna be bothered about that.
This is
Oh,
that was published in a newspaper as a warning to the public.
Oh my God, I want a follow up with these ladies.
They are all dead of cancer.
I want a luncheon with these ladies.
Oh my God.
And I just want to throw like a shit grenade in there with some of my own thoughts and feelings and then run off.
You have blue hair and a lot of tattoos. You are the shit grenade to these ladies.
This is true.
And
this
a lot of clothes with the F word on it.
Yeah, this is true.
Which you can purchase at wineandcrimepodcast.bigcartel.com.
Oh, yeah, you can. So in general, I think that these types of fantasy role-playing games attract people who are looking for some kind of escape and connection, like an outlet for their imagination. And unfortunately, those desires, specifically like escape and connection, often stem from feelings of isolation, which can breed depression. So while there may be some overlap in criminal and violent activity and board games, there's probably also a lot of overlap with criminal and violent activity and like tapioca pudding. So like, calm your tits.
Correlation, not causation.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
A lot of people play board games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, it goes without saying that older generations love to find problems with youthful trends.
So youthful.
Youthful. What was it? Nocturnal youth. So the bottom line here is let people play their fucking board games. And if you feel despondent or detached or depressed and feel like role-playing games are your only release, treat your brain, look into therapy to help you find fulfillment elsewhere as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Absolutely.
That's my segment.
Nicely done.
Thank you.
So good.
Well, we want to hear a word from our sponsors.
Let's do it. Getting in shape doesn't have to be about losing weight or losing a specific amount of weight or hitting some magic number on a scale. It is about building healthier habits and just feeling better about yourself. So if fitting into your favorite pair of jeans is your goal, great. But there are many reasons you might want to practice self-care, especially during these difficult times. And every person is different. So some of my non-weight, non-scale related health goals are just having more energy throughout the day and just feeling a bit fitter, you know, like not panting at the same level as my dog when I take her on a walk. That's a goal for me.
Yeah, cutting down on the bloat in general.
Mm-hmm.
And as somebody who works from home and now, like, most everybody should be working from home at this particular time. But it is hard to, it's hard to pay that close of attention to what you're eating, especially if you're stressed out. You can have, you can like eat emotionally or eat out of stress. And it really takes some sort of conscious accountability for you to stay on track with your goals in terms of both, you know, diet and exercise. And that's why we really love working with Noom. It is an incredibly easy app to navigate. They have your, like a, an accountability, a goals coach that can help you stay on track, that can kind of give you ideas for like, if you're just really, really sick of taking walks in the same neighborhood, they can give you ideas. You can talk to the people in the Noom community to help you get more like new recipes, new exercise ideas. One thing that I really love about Noom is, like I said, how convenient the app is. They can, that teaches you lessons, specific lessons, that kind of ingrain the psychology behind why you do the things that you do. It asks for just 10 minutes a day. Nothing is very judgmental at all. It's just like a really pretty app. They have a really extensive food like inventory, so you can log all of your food. That is crucial to seeing what you do, when you do it, and why you do it.
Mm-hmm.
Noom has one of the biggest and most accurate food databases available that lets you track those meal habits and visualize your portion sizes, see calorie density, which turns out is a thing, and it's very important to understand that. And Noom is the habit-changing solution that just helps users learn to develop a new relationship with food through personalized courses. I love it.
Mm-hmm. And you don't have to change it all in one day because small steps can make big progress. Sign up for your trial today at noom.com/gals. That's noom.com/GALS. And invest in your self-care today. Visit noom.com/gals to start your trial today. Again, that is noom.com/GALS. Treat your bod.
Treat it. Remember sex ed when we learned to prevent pregnancy at all costs?
Yes. How times have changed.
Some of those videos just really didn't age well. Mm-hmm. But today we have all the tools to prevent pregnancy, but when it comes to actually planning ahead for it, it's a mystery. Like, we get how it works, but what does that really
details.
Do? No. Lots of mystery there. So it is time for fertility education, people. Mm-hmm. That's why Modern Fertility was created. It's the easy and affordable way to test your fertility hormones at home with a simple finger prick. Mail it in with a prepaid label and you will get your personalized results within 10 days. It is so fast. It's like magic.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. It's just science and it's incredible. Traditional testing with your doctor can cost over $1,000, but Modern Fertility only costs $159 to get the exact same information. And if you go to modernfertility.com/gals, you can get $20 off your test.
Mm-hmm. Also, if you have an HSA or an FSA, you can use those dollars on Modern Fertility, which is so great. You'll also get insight into how many eggs you have, hormone levels, and any reproductive red flags that you should be aware of. And the results go in depth into what every hormone means. And you can also talk one-on-one with a fertility nurse to review your results and options for next steps. It is just a no-brainer. It is such a smooth, easy process. And at the end of it, you feel empowered with information. I took my test and I'm so grateful that I did, and I recommend it to all of my friends who are, you know, in their mid to late 30s and figuring life out and trying to decide what their next steps for their fertility might be. So if you want kids today or just maybe one day, you need information to make the decision that is best for you. And right now, Modern Fertility is offering our listeners $20 off a test when you go to modernfertility.com/gals, G-A-L-S. That means your test will cost $139 instead of the hundreds or even thousands it could cost at the doctor's office. Get $20 off your fertility test when you go to modernfertility.com/gals. modernfertility.com/gals. So, my case. This ties in with kind of the end of Lucy's segment in that it's not the games that are to blame in any way. Mm-hmm. It's people with pre-existing mental health issues that go unaddressed and or insufficiently addressed and then kind of lose the ability to tell reality from fiction and right. fantasy.
The game which could doesn't happen with cause anything. Any of this.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So that is just out there. Also, we have a tendency to side with female murderesses,
mm-hmm.
or at least empathize with them.
I just get it.
But
dating is hard.
I fucking hate this bitch. So
good.
Just putting that out there. Not a fan. So, Robert Schwartz was a successful scientist whose work in microbiology and DNA sequencing had brought him international recognition. He co-founded the Virginia Biotechnology Association after settling down in Leesburg, Virginia. Robert got married, bought a picturesque old farmhouse, and had three children, Michelle, Jesse, and Clara Jane.
Mm-hmm.
Sadly, Robert's wife passed away when the children were still young, but he threw himself into single fatherhood, devoting himself to raising the three kids on his own and continuing his successful career.
Good on ya, gal.
Mm-hmm. Good on ya, Robert. So his relationship with his youngest, Clara Jane, however, was always a bit difficult, and things grew even more volatile when Clara Jane became a teenager, as they do.
Mm-hmm. Especially with a double name like Clara Jane.
Yeah, some reports just referred to her as Clara, but enough of them referred to her as Clara Jane that I went with it.
I like it. Sounds like an American Girl doll.
Does. Definitely does. She would be the worst American Girl doll, let me just say.
She's a bit. I can already tell you she's a bitch.
She's scary. She cray. So she's a teenager. Not getting along with her single dad. Robert found her and her interests difficult to understand. He was a hard-nosed scientist. She was deeply obsessed with magic and fantasy, especially stories of vampires and assassins.
Ooh, I feel that, though.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. For her part, Clara Jane felt her father was unreasonable and made her feel like she could never do anything right, which is like every teenager ever.
Yeah. But I love him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Daddy, I love him.
I remember so vividly being in a fight with my mom, which was not that unusual, and screaming at her, "You didn't even know I have a boyfriend." I didn't have a boyfriend. She was like,
"That's
what?
Cruel.
Well,
that's cruel.
Does he want to come over for dinner?"
Yeah, tell me about him. And you're like, shit, I got to scrounge up a boyfriend.
I know. I think it was during the 48 hours I quote unquote dated you know who. Rhymes with Schmalek Staddles.
Yes.
Who is like one of our most devout grassroots marketers. He tells everybody about our show. It's so cute. I just saw him like 2 weeks ago. Hi, Schmalek
Schmattles. We saw him at the American Authors Show. Anyway, okay. So Robert criticized his daughter's goth clothing and her choice of friends. But at the same time, if she didn't hang out with anyone, he criticized her for spending too much time alone in her room. Which, like, also classic parent slash dad bullshit. More concerningly, Clara Jane also said that her father had punched her and pulled her hair. And she also claimed that he, quote, often tried to poison her food.
Often?
Okay, well, I don't like to speculate about domestic abuse claims because it can be really hard, if not impossible, to know what actually goes on in a house and in a family behind closed doors. So, like, you know, it's possible, But it should be said that there's no evidence to support the poisoning claim, and her phrasing is pretty weird. And also, like, if he wanted to poison one of his kids, he could have. So, like, how often is it going to take Clara Jane?
Right.
Also, statistically, doesn't Munchausen's by proxy, if that's what was going on, that's typically for women.
It's just not true, okay?
Okay.
Is what it is.
There we go.
And Clara Jane's other two siblings have strongly denied that their father ever abused any of his children. And her two siblings are like, she's making this up. He was a great father to all of us. There was never any abuse. So again, I wasn't there. I wasn't a part of this family. But what happens next makes me think that this is all bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, it's clear that Clara Jane and her dad don't have a great relationship. And in 2001, when she was 20 years old, she moved out of her father's farmhouse in Leesburg to attend James Madison University, which is about an hour and 40-minute drive away, and where she majored in computer science. But the move away from home did not lessen Clara Jane's resentment towards her father, and she shared stories of his quote-unquote mistreatment with several new college acquaintances. So she was like, hey, nice to meet you. I hate my dad.
I've met people like that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes it's justified, and I don't know. One of these new friends was 19-year-old Kyle Holbert, who Clara Jane had met at a Renaissance fair that fall.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, my God. I so love that.
Mm-hmm.
I love the Ren Fest.
What a meet cute for two goths. It sucks that they both turned out to be such shitheads, because that's a really meet cute.
Don't all goth couples meet at the Ren Fest?
Where else do you meet?
I didn't realize there were alternatives.
Oh, God.
I love a good Ren Fest.
They just Lady and the Tramp to Bread Bowl.
Yes.
It was really messy, actually.
Dipped their hands in wax together.
Oh, holding hands in the wax. Their star charts aligned. Oh, my God. All right. So the two immediately bonded over a common interest in witchcraft and the occult. Kyle often engaged in fantasy role-playing games as a, quote, warrior. And when Clara Jane confided in him about her suspicions that her father was poisoning her, he declared himself her protector.
Oh, good.
Always a good thing.
Clara Jane encouraged Kyle's role-playing as her protector, but she herself did not play a damsel in distress. She often referred to herself as, quote, the High Priestess of Chaos, and claimed to operate under the principle that, quote, nothing is true and everything is permitted.
Okay.
That's not a great worldview.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Feel very uncomfortable about this. Continue.
Yeah, it's all going in a really good and safe direction so far.
Super safe, very positive. Posy vibes only.
Not foreboding at all.
Mm-hmm. And that motto was actually pretty spot on, because with Clara Jane, it was often unclear where the game ended and where truth, or at least reality, began. She would intersperse the fantasy role-playing with very real-sounding confessions about her father's so-called abuse and her alleged fear that he might kill her.
Mm.
So she purposefully kind of muddled these things when speaking with Kyle. Clara Jane even confided to Kyle that her father was planning on taking her on vacation to the Virgin Islands. How dare he?
Yeah.
The nerve.
And she was afraid that she would not return alive.
Okay.
I mean, she's so fine by me. If I have to die in the Virgin Islands, sign me up.
Better than dying in Virginia.
Good Lord, isn't it, though?
Actually, I have nothing against Virginia. It's quite beautiful.
It's just not the Virgin Islands.
Right. It's important to note that whatever undiagnosed mental health issues Clara Jane might have had, Kyle Holbert had a long and documented history of mental illness. He'd been diagnosed with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder and had spent a large portion of his childhood in mental institutions. So she's muddling fantasy and reality and seeking out this boy, essentially, as her protector, and like creating a villain for him to oppose.
Yeah.
And he already has mental health issues that make it difficult for him to sometimes assess reality.
Sure.
This super sounds like Gypsy Rose.
Yes, a little bit, yeah. It's pretty similar, yeah. Mm-hmm. Except Gypsy Rose's mom actually was a monster.
Yeah, but like the boyfriend with the mm-hmm. mental health issues and the enemy and the whatever.
Yep, absolutely. Throughout, he had coped by creating a fantasy world in which he was the protector of the downtrodden. And this unquestionably played a role in skewing his perception of reality and taking the game with Clara Jane too far. Mm. But when the game did get out of hand, it was not Kyle alone who was responsible. On December 8th, 2001, which was a cold, rainy night, just like you would imagine it, Kyle and two of his friends, a 22-year-old named Michael Fole and a 20-year-old named Catherine Inglis, and Michael and Catherine were dating, went to visit Clara Jane at her JMU dorm room. But this wasn't just a fun visit. Clara Jane had given Kyle $60 to pay for gas and told him to buy a bandana to cover his face as well as gloves. Ooh.
Ominous.
$60 for a bandana and gloves? Oh, and gas.
No, for gas.
Gotcha.
Et tu bandana.
Yes. No. I was waiting. Et tu bandana and gloves and gas.
Hulbert, Full, and Inglis then drove 100 miles from James Madison University to Schwartz's farmhouse in Leesburg, while Clara Jane stayed snug in her dorm room. She literally sent three assassins, basically, to her father with, like, gas money and a fucking bandana.
Yep.
Well, that's how it would have worked in a game. Yeah. You don't ever have to do your own dirty work. If you have assassins, why not use them?
That's true. 2 days later, Robert Schwartz's body was discovered by a coworker after he did not show up to work. He had been stabbed at least 30 times with a 27-inch sword.
Oh, my God. Ouch.
Right as he was sitting down to dinner.
That's big.
Ugh.
Yeah, and he was at home alone because Clara Jane was his youngest, and she was off to college, so the other ones were out of the house as well.
My God.
Stabbed with a sword at the dinner table.
Not how I would want to go out.
Mm-mm.
I'd rather die in the Virgin Islands.
Yes, correct. When police went to JMU to notify Clara Jane about her father's death, she immediately threw her protector under the fucking bus.
Wow. Didn't even try to hold out? Not even a minute?
Oh, nope. What a
telling
bitch.
The authorities that she'd had suspicions that Kyle might be the murderer.
Okay.
Indeed, police found the murder weapon. Again, it was a fucking sword. In Hulbert's apartment and arrested him for murder. However, accomplice Catherine Inglis then gave a statement to the police implicating Clara Jane, claiming that she had heard her discuss her father's murder ahead of time with Kyle and with Catherine's boyfriend, Michael Full. When Kyle was interviewed by police, he claimed that he had acted alone, entering the house while Full and Inglis waited in the car, confronting Robert Schwartz about the alleged abuse and slashing him with the sword. However, when police obtained a warrant to search Clara Jane's dorm room and property, they discovered instant message conversations indicating that she had prior knowledge of the murder. So they got her.
AIM away message.
Yeah. BRB.
Gave it away.
Sending my assassins to kill my father.
Yeah. Sending my friend to kill my dad.
Yeah.
In Comic Sans with every
because
other letter
capitalized.
Because
I don't want to go to the Virgin Islands.
Yeah. Tildes and asterisks and like glittery letters.
Ultimately, all four of these people, Clara Jane, Kyle, Michael, and Catherine, were indicted for the murder, with Clara Jane also being charged with conspiracy to commit murder and solicitation of murder. Clara Jane's defense attorneys argued that she had simply been venting about her frustrations with her father, but had not believed Kyle would take these statements as encouragement to actually murder him. But here's gas money to drive 100 miles.
Right? And an instruction to get bandanas to cover your faces.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not gonna hold up, honey.
This was thrown into question, however, by one of the prosecution's witnesses, an ex-boyfriend of Clara Jane's.
Yes.
A man named Patrick House.
Schmalek Schmaddles. Oh,
Schmalek Schmaddles.
Schmalek Schmaddles. House testified that this was not the first time that Clara Jane had encouraged someone to murder her father.
No way.
On the witness stand, House described how when they had begun dating in the summer of 2001, only a couple months before she met Kyle Hulbert.
It was the summer of 2001.
Really bad music and white belts.
Yeah. Von Dutch hats.
Chunky highlights and lip gloss
and logo tees.
Yep.
Okay, so
platform flip flops. Sorry.
Von Dutch skirts.
Butterfly clips. I'm gonna go to the Virgin Islands and get my hair done in braids and beads.
Oh, because no one has mentioned cultural appropriation.
The 2001 white girl vacation starter kit.
Frosty. Yeah.
Platform sandals. Frosted tips.
Frosty eyeshadow.
Oh, yeah.
Super wet lips. It was just the like, summer of 2001.
Looking like a Nickelback B-side.
Looking like you just went down on Aquaman was such a look.
Yeah, on a glazed donut. Anyway, back to this tragedy, but that was a fucking amazing musical moment.
So, back in the summer of 2001.
It was the summer of 2001.
White belts.
Puka shells and white belts.
And chunky sandals.
Oh, I love platform chunky sandals. Bring them back.
Chunky highlights, flip-flops. Chunky sandals. Chunky peanut butter.
Chunky belts.
Chunky belts.
Really tiny eyebrows. Okay, so.
So tiny.
Only a couple of months before she met Kyle Hulbert, she was dating Patrick House, and they had engaged in a role-playing game called Underworld, in which Clara Jane played a character called Lord Chaos and ordered his character, Patrick's character, who was an assassin-for-hire character.
A hashashin,
to kill her father, who they referred to with the snappy and impenetrable code name Old Guy.
Stop. Old dad.
My old dad. Robert. My old dad, Robert. According to Patrick, Clara Jane had even gone so far as to research herbal poisons that would make her father's death appear natural, and often made comments about how much she stood to inherit if Schwartz died, and her worries about being cut out of the will because of their contentious relationship.
Okay.
She was fully planning this for months and she found someone.
The most obvious trail of breadcrumbs the entire time.
Yeah. So when Patrick realized that Clara Jane did not seem to just be playing a game.
Oh, no.
He broke things off. Clara Jane's uncle, Christopher Schwartz, came to her defense. He was one of the only family members to do so. He took the stand as a character witness and claimed that while she was troubled, she never would have actually wanted her father dead, but like...
Uh-huh.
She soups did.
Yeah, how do you know, Christopher? Kay. According to him, Clara Jane had a hyperthyroid condition that often caused her to become confused and paranoid, but she was ultimately a good person.
No.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm calling big bullshit on your thyroid making you intricately plan to have your father assassinated.
Yeah, for months.
Sorry,
and months.
No. Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
This was not enough to sway the jury, shockingly, and Clara Jane Schwartz was convicted of first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and 2 counts of solicitation of murder for both Patrick and Kyle. Both of Clara Jane's older siblings spoke at her sentencing hearing, indicating that even the harshest sentence would not make up for their loss of their father. So they were like, throw the book at her, but also like, we miss our dad. 22-year-old Michelle stated that she was, quote, haunted by nightmares of her father's last moments and that the sight of a knife makes her uneasy.
Oh, wow. Poor thing.
It's really sad.
She went on to say that, quote, it's hard enough it was my father, but on top of that, to have my sister committing such a horrible crime, which, like, I can't even fathom.
No, that would be so hard.
When the judge asked Clara Jane if she had anything to say before sentencing, she replied, quote, nothing that hasn't already been said.
Wow.
So at least she showed remorse.
God.
Deep, right? Heartfelt remorse.
Gosh.
From the bottom of her thyroid.
From the bottom of her thyroid.
Her cold black thyroid.
Her icy, icy thyroid.
She was
Tell my thyroid, my achy, breaky thyroid. I just don't think he'd understand. Because if you tell my thyroid, my achy, breaky thyroid, I might grow up to kill my dad.
You're so good at that.
I'm on fire today. Let's keep this going.
She was sentenced to 48 years in prison. Sayonara.
Later, boner.
As for the other participants, Kyle Hulbert was sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole for first-degree murder because he had actually done the slaying.
Yeah, he super did it with a sword.
Yeah. He was remorseful at his sentencing and claimed that he truly thought he'd been doing the right thing, telling the judge that, quote, there is nothing I wouldn't give to take that act back. I allowed myself to be poisoned by Clara. Which, like, is true.
I get it. I kind of believe it.
Yeah.
He was already so vulnerable. Like, preying on vulnerable people is pretty fucked up. Like, I don't know what's worse, committing the act or being the one who is the puppeteer.
Oh, I think she's a full-on sociopath.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Michael Foal pleaded guilty to second-degree murder, admitting that he knew that Hulbert planned to kill Schwartz and had agreed to drive him, and he was sentenced to 18 years. Can you imagine being this dude?
That would
be like, God, getting wrapped up in this. And Catherine Inglis served 1 year in prison for conspiracy to commit murder, basically because she rode along in the car and then didn't, like, immediately report it.
Yeah, y'all do not want to associate with, once you know, run the other way and just tell the police. Because if you withhold that information and they find out you knew, you could be charged with conspiracy.
Yep.
And so, it's not worth it. Yeah,
I mean, she was involved in a conspiracy. I mean, she was like, here's the money, here's the sword. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, she could have prevented this person's death and didn't.
Yeah. Clara Jane has made many attempts to appeal her conviction, all of which have been unsuccessful. Her grandfather told a reporter in 2003 that he hoped she would show remorse for what she had done in time, but that, quote, she had free choices and her choices were always the bad ones.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the case.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
What a wild ride.
What was the game?
It was some role-playing game and something called Underworld.
Oh, Underworld, right, Underworld. And then, yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Wow. Yikes. Good work.
Nice job.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Well, let's hear another word from our sponsor, Mattel Dice. Roll your life away with Mattel Dice.
Here's an honest question. How are you supposed to know what to do with your money? That is such a fair question.
Never learned about it in school. I learned how to sew like a duffel bag. I didn't learn how to handle money.
No, not at all. Very few of us are exposed to meaningful advice on how to manage our finances. Even fewer have the means to get professional financial guidance. Preach. Betterment is a platform that was built to do something radical, to give accessible financial advice that puts you first. Sign me up.
Mm-hmm. So if you're like most Americans, your money is probably sitting in a savings account, likely earning you next to nothing. Hand raised. Mm-hmm. Maybe you have an investment account that you're not really sure what to do with. Betterment can help you make sense of what to do with your money. Investing involves risk, but you don't have to know the ins and outs of the stock market to start saving more or start investing for your future. Betterment's technology will put your money to work, choosing the stocks and strategies that are right for you, because we know you have other things to do than, you know, learning everything there is to know about the stock market.
Absolutely not.
Betterment's platform can even provide guidance on what financial goals make sense for you, which I find very helpful.
Absolutely. So give your money a new home with Betterment, peace of mind included. Download the Betterment app today. That is BETTERMENT for the betterment of you. Treat your pocketbook.
Treat it.
At times like this, it is crucial not to leave your house unnecessarily. And that's why being able to order things to just come to your door on autopilot is like so essential. So if you are maybe reusing your contact lenses more than you should be just for the sake of preserving them, please don't do that. It can really make your eyes gross in a hurry. Trust me.
Not worth it.
I've been there. So you can avoid the crowds and keep your eyes healthy and get those contacts that you can afford delivered straight to your door with Hubble. I am on the Hubble train, people. It is remarkable. First of all, these are high-quality lenses, and they are less expensive than any other lenses I have ever purchased, and I've been wearing contacts since the seventh grade. So you can get 2 weeks of lenses for just a dollar. There's no stress, no hassle to start a monthly subscription, and that subscription is super easy to modify or cancel at any time. Like I said, this is on autopilot. You can get a month's worth of daily lenses delivered to your door. Also, the packaging is really pretty. I am a sucker for good packaging. So contact lenses have been way overpriced for a very long time until Hubble. Hubble offers more affordable daily lenses by selling directly to you. You can get quality daily lenses for a fraction of the cost of the other guys or gals or both or neither. And if you have no prescription, don't worry. Hubble can connect you to an optometrist near you. Ordering, like plugging in my prescription information, I thought I'd like missed a step because it was so incredibly simple. And when they came, I had never been one to use one-time use contacts. But let me tell you, if this is a new thing for you, it is so nice. I was afraid of like the cost per day of wearing contacts because, like I said, they can be really expensive. These are not those. Contacts from Hubble, totally affordable, extremely comfortable, and like I said, I am on that daily use train.
And Hubble has really great customer service, which I like.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So don't leave your home more than you need to. Set up a convenient contact lens subscription with Hubble to get your monthly supply sent straight to you. You'll get 2 weeks of daily lenses shipped straight to your door for just $1. That's 30 contacts for just $1 at HubbleContacts.com, H-U-B-B-L-E, contacts.com. And don't forget to select our show in the post-checkout survey so that we get credit for sending you.
Absolutely. And treat your eyeballs.
Treat it. We recently discovered our new favorite subscription. It is called CauseBox, and I need to tell you about it. CauseBox is a quarterly, so four times a year, subscription box curated by women for folks, and it is filled with all sorts of amazing products and brands that are ethical, sustainable, and have a positive mission to give back and make the world better. So it's like self-care that is caring for you and also caring for the world at large. It's amazing. Every CauseBox is limited edition and comes with 6 to 8 full-size products. So these are not little dinky sample sizes that you run out after 2 uses. These are full-size products. And you can get everything from skincare and jewelry to homewares and accessories. The last 4 CauseBoxes sold out within days. which I can believe because you get over $250 worth of products for only $50.
Oh my lord. These boxes, it's like a full birthday party's worth of gifts in these boxes. And yeah. It's just, mine came in the mail the other day and it came around like 1 p.m. and I saved it so that I could have a glass of wine and I could light a candle and I could open my Cosbox because it just felt like such an event.
Yes, it's so great. Especially nowadays when you can't go out and go shopping. It's like bringing all of that fun and excitement to you, to your house.
Receiving this has been the highlight of my week, for sure. I got a jade roller, which is currently in my refrigerator, so I can really treat my face later today. There's a really cute striped duffel bag. Mm. I have so many plans for it when I can finally leave my house again. there's like a little postcard with a just really cute artwork on it. It just makes you happy. There's jewelry. You can get candles. I got some primer. Just like fun self-care stuff. And like we said, one of the best parts was just getting that box in the mail and the anticipation. And the box is just so pretty. And it's life just feels so dreary. And it was just like, just such a ray of sunshine. And again,
I love the portfolio.
Yeah.
It's like an oversized clutch. Adorable. Oh.
Yeah, so when I'm just staring down the barrel of many weeks of just working from home exclusively, at least I can make my, like, office and paperwork look really cute. Mm-hmm. And I have recommended a Cosbox subscription to all of my friends, to my mom, to my sister. It's just so fun. And the best part is that, of course, our listeners get an exclusive discount. Go to causebox.com/gals and use the code GALS, that's G-A-L-S, to get your first box for 30% off. And abracadabra, here's the math for you. That means you get your first box worth over $250 for less than $39. There's no reason not to do this. So go check out Causebox right now. We promise you, you're going to love it. Treat yourself.
Treat you.
So my case is not very long, but it's pretty bonkers and it's super sad. So buckle up.
Super sad.
Super sad. Like I said, since I blew my load on the hilarity of the bridge game murder case, I had to go in a different direction.
I will be pouring more wine for this.
Yep. Before we get started, I'm going to give a brief overview of the game of Street Dice. Ooh. Which is a simplified version of classic craps that you can see folks of every walk of life playing in, especially New York, in the borough of Harlem. Mm-hmm. Those of us who grew up on the mean streets of Minnetonka only got a taste of this while participating in their high school production of Guys and Dolls, so I consulted WikiHow for a rundown.
Wow.
So, from WikiHow, yeah, I needed to pad this case a little bit, obviously. WikiWow. Regular street craps is played with two dice, which are used by a single player in each game, though the game can be played by any number of onlookers. And before I continue, just like when I was describing the game of bridge,
don't
understand any of this, and I don't want anyone to ask me any questions. Here we go.
Got it.
Players will first roll the dice to determine who will roll for that particular game, and then all the participants will place bets on whether or not the person rolling will, quote, pass on the first roll by rolling a 7 or an 11, or crap out by rolling a 2, a 3, or a 12. If one of those values is reached on the first roll, the game is over and the bets are distributed accordingly. The player shooting the dice is the first to bet, and the other players must at least match his bet before the game can continue. If the bet cannot be matched, the shooter can either lower the bet to accommodate the other players or handicap the odds. Once the shooter's bet has been matched, the other players may place side bets. If the shooter neither passes nor craps out on the first roll, then the number rolled becomes the point. Now, only the two values that matter on the roll are that point value and 7. The player must continue rolling until either the point or 7 is reached. All bets that the shooter would pass are now bets that the shooter will re-roll the value of the point before rolling a 7, and all bets to the contrary are the bets that 7 will be rolled first. If the game goes to point, as soon as the shooter rolls the point or 7, the game is over and the bets are awarded accordingly.
This is a lot more complicated than I thought.
Super clear. Yep.
In one ear and out the other.
100%. Just like the breakfast burrito I had this morning.
So they use dice, right?
Yeah, yep. So they're shooting craps. Moving on.
So they roll dice to figure out who rolls the dice first, but how do they determine who should roll the dice first to know who should roll the dice first?
It's remember like, when I said don't ask any questions?
It's probably like who gets the highest roll.
I was being facetious.
On the evening of January 6th, 2013, two friends, Michael Lee, age 29, and Tevin Bolden, age 18, were enjoying a warm Sunday evening in Garyville, Louisiana, with a game of dice in their neighborhood on Little Hope Street, which there is a photo on the drive, and the street seems aptly named given the state of the neighborhood.
Little Hope.
Little Hope.
I don't think they thought that through.
They didn't. And it's a pretty barren trailer community that looks as though it's been overlooked for many years. It's actually quite sad.
Oh.
The entire point of dice is to bet and win money. So the two men made it interesting. Things were going just fine, and the lifelong friends appeared to be having a great time until Michael hit a winning streak and took Tevin for all the cash he had. Suddenly, in a rage over the loss, Tevin pulled a gun on Michael and fired several shots. He hit Michael 5 times, twice in the chest and 3 times in the back, which indicates he got 2 shots in before Michael turned to flee and then landed 3 more.
Damn.
Some reports state that over 12 shots were fired, with 5 hitting Michael and the others hitting nearby homes and cars.
Don't play a game if you're not comfortable losing everything you put into it.
I know.
Yeah.
Yep. Tevin took off, leaving Michael bleeding but responsive in the street. EMTs arrived swiftly, and Michael was taken to nearby River Parish's hospital, where he died a few hours later. Michael left behind his girlfriend and their 2-year-old child. His girlfriend is Tevin's older sister, Shangalisha Davis. So according to Michael's sister, the deceased, Natoya, quote, there was never any beef between Michael and Tevin, never any competition. He used to sleep at their house. They grew up together, always spent time together. There was nothing, no feud, no nothing. But the members of the Lee family have a sinister and tragic reason to mistrust the Boldens, dating back long before this tragic game of dice. And this is why I picked this case, because it's just like so interesting, this family feud history.
I just can't believe that somebody murdered their like best friend, childhood friend, and essentially brother-in-law over a game of dice.
I know. And it makes you wonder if what we're about to hear next obviously has something to do with it, but it's like, it's odd because the two were friends despite the family feud. So we'll just keep going here.
Okay.
Over 30 years, in April of 1980, Michael's mother, Cassana Pembroke, was only 32 years old and still pregnant with Natoya when her life changed forever. She got the news that her husband, Reginald, had been murdered in a bar fight, leaving her widowed with 10 children.
No.
Can you even fucking imagine? Yeah, Michael is one of 10 children, the youngest. Or
11,
Natoya is the youngest.
Because Natoya.
Yeah, it's bonkers. So the two men charged with the crime were Roosevelt Batiste and Leroy Bolden, Tevin's grandfather and Tevin's uncle. And again, Tevin is the shooter in this new case. Understandably, since then, there had been tension between the families. Cassandra said, quote, my daughter never saw her daddy because of the Boldens. And of Michael's murder, she stated, quote, I don't care how long it takes or how many years in jail he gets. I want him to pay for what he did to my child. Now I want justice. Can you even blame her? Because of the friendship between Michael and Tevin, as well as Michael's romantic relationship with Tevin's sister, Shangalisha, a few members of the family truly believed they were headed toward a peaceful resolve. Shangalisha maintained her brother's innocence, saying, quote, my brother is indeed a good person. Michael and my brother didn't have words. Their relationship was really good. It was just a dice game, and it wasn't my brother who shot Michael. So she didn't even believe that it was Michael's fault. Tevin's fault.
Weird.
It's kind of like a Romeo and Juliet type
thing. It really is. It's so odd. That's exactly what I was thinking. But Michael's other sister, Tracy, feels otherwise. Quote, whoever the Boldens come in contact with, if anybody crosses them, they're ready to take them out. I could be out in Metairie, where I live.
It's that neighborhood in New Orleans, right?
I think so. And I'd still hear about the Boldens in Garyville. Regardless of the family's conflicting feelings, Tevin was wanted for second-degree murder, attempted second-degree murder, aggravated criminal damage to property, and illegal use of a weapon. He had taken off on foot right after the shooting and stayed out of sight for 3 days. There was like a huge manhunt looking for him. And then 3 days after the shooting, while wanted by police and with many witnesses that were also outside playing dice that identified him as Michael's killer, Tevin did turn himself into the St. John Baptist Parish Sheriff's Office and was charged and sentenced. But I tried to find like follow up about how long his sentence was, how long he has been spending in jail, and I couldn't find it. So I think this is, it's a really interesting story. And it's just one of those.
Didn't get that much attention.
I don't think it got that much attention because, A, unfortunately, these are, these are men of color committing gun violence. And so it just doesn't get, like, if there weren't the family history between these two to make this an interesting news story, quote unquote, we'd never know about any of this. Yep. And it's just, it's so fucked up. The whole thing is so sad. But as I was reading this, I was like, totally thinking Romeo and Juliet vibes, where like the families are starting to come together because the two, the Michael
they could.
And
there's that Shangalisha potential.
Literally had a baby together. Like they were talking about getting married and like things were going really, really well. And the families seemed to respect their partnership on like Romeo and Juliet. But it's like, what had to have gone down for Tevin to go from playing a game of dice with a lifelong friend to shooting him 5 times.
Impulse control not being there in that particular person.
Yeah, because like you said, there were like dozens of witnesses. It's not like he expected to get away with it. It was like an impulsive rage situation.
And all the like supports the idea of just that impulse control that he would then take off, knowing full well that all of these witnesses saw him and he's not going to get away with it.
Yeah,
he just got scared and ran. So like that's just really unfortunate. And that's my case.
Well, that's horrific.
Short and sweet and about dice.
Good job.
There you go. Mm-hmm. You nailed it. Well, this was an interesting episode. Special thanks to the Wine and Dice Party and all the names that we listed at the top. We love each and every one of you. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. I want in. Invite us to your next party.
With all that free time that we have, I want in.
Thank you also to Nashame Megan.
It's a shame you didn't send a name pronunciation guide.
There it is. Thank you to Caitlin Moore Morley. Amazing.
We want more of you.
We definitely want more and more.
More Morley. How do you like it?
How do you like it? Thank you, Caitlin.
Thank you to Justine Anaya. You have annihilated the game with your donation. Yes. Thank you.
Nicely done.
I was doing finger guns at the screen. You couldn't see it.
Yeah, you were.
We felt it.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sarah Cox. Don't know if I should make a cock joke.
You should. You absolutely should. That's not even a question.
What's a cock joke?
Exactly. Cox in the hen house. Sarah Cox in
Cox
the hen house.
Cox in the hen house. Thank you. I'm struggling. I don't know why.
Thank you to Jade Weltcheck. I will check that welt. And also, I will read your shout out to your friend, Katie Angel, and let them know that she is the light of my life. And I miss that bitch.
Miss checking those welts. What'd you do with her?
Yeah. I don't know. But check each other's welts.
check. Friends check their friends' welts. Thank you to Abby Jewell. You are more precious to us than the family jewels, than the Abby jewels.
Thank you to Alex Ward for helping us ward off those creditors with your generous support.
Yep. Good one. Thank you to Tara Hedges. I'm going to trim those hedges with your consent. Or leave them be. You do you.
Thank you to Simone Eleanor. Very elegant name. Simone Eleanor.
Thank you also, Hannah Marie. I'd Marie you any day.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And thank you, Mike Daly. I'm going to send you daily updates of gratitude thanks to your donation.
Thank you to Christina Watson, who increased from $2 to $5 a month.
Thank Christina you, our dear Watson.
Yeah, Christina knows what's up.
Yeah.
Kicking off
what's our... What's new, pussycat? Sorry.
Kicking off our $10 a month tier, Mariana Shalino, you'll be getting a free fucking patriarchy flexible wine glass.
Nice.
Shalino's.
What?
Shalino's like, it.
She, yeah, like Shalino already knows. Like Shalino's. Knows.
Oh, I followed. No. It was bad, but I followed it.
Okay. Yeah. I'm glad you tackled that one. Thank you.
Thank you to Hunter Williams. I will be hunting down those yams this coming Thanksgiving.
Yams.
I love yams.
Thank you to Rachel Dane. Den?
I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know. I wouldn't deign to know. Thank you to Caitlin Weber, weaving that sweet web. I'm just like a dragonfly stuck in your web of support.
Wow-ish. I thought you said sucking your web. It's like, why would a dragonfly be sucking her web?
Nope, didn't say
that. That don't make no sense. Well, kick it off our $15 a month
gross
tier.
Suck it on this web is...
Suck it on this trash queen or king or neither or neither or both web is Kate Benson, who I can only assume is related to Olivia Benson of Law & Order SVU. Absolute Quinn.
Thank you for your service.
Yeah.
Also, thank you to Camille Brooks. $15 a month can buy us a lot of books, a lot of Dungeons and Dragon books.
It sure can.
Meredith Brooks can buy us a lot of Meredith Brooks CDs.
Yes, cassette tapes.
Thank you, Alana Romy. We're not roaming around looking for a couple dollars here and there anymore because of your support.
Exactly. And to Tracy Fuggit.
I'm so jealous.
Fuggit, we'll do it live.
Fuggit, you're doing it live.
It's probably Fugit, but I'm going with Fuggit.
We're going with Fuggit.
Fuggit, I'm going with Fuggit.
Fuggit, we'll do it live. Thank you for having the patience to wait till the second to last person in special thanks, Patience Velasco.
You know what goes good with eggs? Velasco sauce.
Velasco. Patience is second to Velasco.
Last but not least, we got Stephanie West. I'm going to head west and dig for gold in your pocket because you're obviously full of it. Thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you all. We'll talk to you next week.
See ya.
God bless and bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Wine and Crime. Our cover art is by Kala Yip. Music by Phil Young and Corey Wendell. Editing by Jonathan Camp. Check out our website and blog at wineandcrimepodcast.com. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Wine and Crime Pod. If you have questions, answers, or recommendations to share, email us at wineandcrimepodcast@gmail.com. Episodes are available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, basically wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And if you like the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. It is the best way to spread the word. If you'd like to show your support and get a shout out on air, visit our Patreon page to keep this podcast and the wine flowing. Cheers!
The day the boys went missing, it was November 10th in 1951.
I should have went with them. I know that. I mean, there's no way to get around that.
Well, they all went down there looking. No sign of them. There hasn't been a sign of them since.
They did close the case and say they drowned in the river. The more I read into it and the more information that my partner and I found, the more I realized, okay, there's something that's just not right, that doesn't fit.
I'd like to make a plea to all you people to help us find our boys.
I'm Jack Elhai, host of the Twin Cities PBS podcast, Long Lost. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. And visit us at tptoriginals.org/longlost.